Notes of Interview with Jesse Haber Butler. This is interview number 4 on 12273. Interview, as usual, took place in Jesse's apartment. With me at the time of this interview was Mimi Simos, a feminist film student who was considering doing a short film on Jesse. This accounts for some of her performance in this interview as compared to her settling down more in some of the previous interviews. The material covered here was the period after her ratification tour with Mrs. Cat and her decision to marry and some of her feelings surrounding this decision and that to leave her career in Washington and follow her husband to England. Most of the interview, however, is concentrated on the years in England, and she went on at length about learning about the child care or child and house management system of the English. There's very little material in this portion of the interview, probably, other than that relating to her going to talk to the various cooperative leagues later. A lot of the material about the Fabians was given earlier off tape, and some of this should be retrieved in the next interview. The period in England essentially represented her playing a housewife, mother, diplomat wife role. And in this role being very much like the American club women of the time. The independent career woman is not evident, although there are stirrings in this period.
The right for copyright. I am Jesse Haber Butler. I now reserve, is that right? I am Jesse Haber Butler. I now reserve the right of this session for copyright purposes.
Now, I'd like to go back to, you went on the tour with Carrie Chapman Catt, and at that time you were still the Secretary of the Consumers League. Now, do you remember what time of the year you got back from that tour?
Well, we were on the tour over the Christmas holiday, and I remember vividly how we stayed at the great hotel in Los Angeles, the Huntington Sheraton Hotel, for the whole Christmas era. And one of the great women of California, who really started the woman suffrage movement in California, was our hostess. And at the moment, I can't remember her name, but she was still alive and lived at the Huntington Sheraton Hotel for many years afterwards, before she passed on. So we had a perfectly delightful Christmas and a lot of celebration, because at every station where we stopped to go and speak to the people interested, there were huge crowds there to greet Mrs. Cat. You never saw such adoration and such admiration and faithfulness that the women gave to that leader. I think possibly that Mrs. Cat had the greatest influence with women and joining women to a great cause of any woman that I've ever heard of. They were all back of her. They were all sacrificing for her. And in all those towns, there was lots of money. Many of the women were very well off, so there was plenty of money around. And they always met her at the train and got her to a hotel, and there was adoration. There was a magnetism about her character that attracted women and made them forget that women in times through the times have always fought each other and been jealous. But there was no jealousy in that program. There was just a dedication to a great issue.
Then you got back to Washington from the tour about when? Remember?
Well, we got back to Washington then sometimes in the early winter, mm-hmm. because we started on the tour before Christmas, and I remember especially, I remember especially what's the great town in Nevada where they go to gamble?
Las Vegas.
And I have a very fascinating incident about Las Vegas. As we were going out of the hotel one morning where she was going to speak to the high school students, there was one of my intimate friends from Washington. And we had all been very enthusiastic about this girl because she had a boyfriend and they finally decided to get married. And what we thought was so exciting was that he was perfectly willing to have her carry on with her job. That was the era when, as soon as you married, you just automatically stopped working. But she'd found a man that wanted her to go on with her job and thought it was a great idea. And we all thought so, too. And here she was in Las Vegas. And I said, well, what are you doing out here? And she said, well, I'm getting a divorce. And we said, what? What's the matter? Well, she said, we got along fine. But then I had a baby. And after I got the baby, I didn't want to work anymore. I want to stay home and take care of the baby. And I found it was rather nice not to crawl out every morning, early in the morning, in the cold days, and go down on the buses and the streetcars and go to a job. It was nicer staying home. But you know, he wouldn't put up with it. He said that we had married on the theory that I was to continue work. And as soon as the baby got a little older, I was to get a babysitter and get back to my job. And he had no intentions of supporting me and the baby. That was the agreement when we got married. So it occurred to me at that point in Las Vegas that we were getting into hot water on some subjects. And some of the women were getting into hot water too. And then there was another incident down in Los Angeles when we were had a tremendous blowout there in San Diego. And when we got on the train that night, across the aisle from me, there was a woman crying all night. And so the next morning, I took a step over to her seat, and she was a young girl, and I asked her what the trouble was. Well, because I had noticed that as she got on the train, there was a very attractive young man saying goodbye to her with a great deal of apparent sorrow between them. Well, the story was that she was still in college, and so was he, but he had decided that she was to give up her college and get a job so he could get his legal degree. And that didn't seem to be her idea of marriage. Giving up her job and earning the money so he could get his degree. So she wrote her mother about it back east, and the mother said, that's terrible. I never heard of such a dreadful thing. She said, you just leave him at once and come back east, and I'll take you on a European trip. So the reason she was crying was that she was leaving him to go back onto the European trip. And again, I thought, well, we seem to be getting into more hot water with some of these ideas, and they don't seem to be very well thought out. So on the side, as we were having the trip, I was picking up some very interesting incidents because I'm a philosopher by nature, and I like to see what's going on and then try to understand what's going on. And I came back from the trip thinking that there was a lot of more study we were going to have to be making into the world in which we were now going as soon as we got woman suffrage.
Well, did you, your own ideas about marriage, you had developed before that, though?
No, I had decided before that I was never going to get married, so life was very simple.
Now, why had you decided that you weren't going to get married?
Well, I had a perfectly awful childhood. And besides that, I had a very exciting time getting myself trained, learning to earn a living, and being free, not only of marriage and children, but of my family. And I'd never been free before. I'd had terrible burdens as a child. My mother died when I was 10, and I had two stepmothers. And the first stepmother died tragically, just as I was going to go to Smith College. And the second stepmother was still on the job. I was very grateful for that, so I didn't have to stay home, take care of my father, as the minister of our church said I should do. When my first stepmother died, I should stay home, take care of my father and the children. But my darling teacher of mathematics called on my father and said that if I didn't get out of there at once, I'd be dead in a year. And he said, well, what will I do? And she said, that's your problem, not hers. And that's how I got on the train and got off to Smith College. So when I got this gorgeous job in Washington of lobbying, which I had adored, I had never been so completely happy and so completely using every talent I had. And it was heaven. So when I met Hugh, he didn't want to get married either. So we just had a nice platonic friendship for 4 years as companions, but not future married partners.
Now, why did you finally change your mind then?
Well, finally I got to be 33 years old, and I looked around at the women that hadn't married and were 40, and I didn't like the picture very well. They didn't seem very happy. One of the most brilliant women in Washington, who'd had a very high position in the government, was now in the mental home for life. I didn't like the looks of that. And then besides, I'd been eating dinner every night with my platonic pal, Hugh, and he got a job at the American Embassy in London, and I began to wonder who would I be eating dinner with. I enjoyed him. He helped me in my work. He loved having me do this kind of work. He was fascinated with it. And he gave me the titles to my speeches. He was a much more brilliant man, mentally, really, than I was as a woman. He was a Welshman, and I was half German, and that's a rather slow-thinking mind. And so whenever I got into a tight place, this alert Welshman always had the answer.
But when you decide, when you thought about marrying, you thought in terms of giving up your career then?
Yeah, oh yes, I had a terrible time about it. And then his mother, that he was very devoted to, came on to Washington to help getting him away without me. And so she told me that he was never going to marry. And after all, I was not having her plan out my life for me either, which I told her, explained to her, that she couldn't tell me what to do with my life. And then I began to want to get married. A little opposition was a good deal.
Well, Jesse, did you ever think, though, about continuing your career with marriage? Or you felt that when you got married, you knew you were going to have to stop?
Well, I knew if I was going to get married and go to England, I couldn't carry on my career as far as I could see. And but I thought I'd like to see England, and I didn't think I'd ever get there any other way. And I heard that the British women whose husbands were in the diplomatic service didn't do any cooking. I thought that it had its charms. A nice trip to England and no cooking and a lot of new world to see. And I was a philosopher, you know. I wanted to see what England was like.
Well, how did you feel? Well, let's backtrack a little bit. When you came back from your tour, it was like the early part of 1920.
That's right.
And you stayed on still with the Consumers League then?
No, then very soon after we got back on the tour, and I can't remember whether it was 6 months or how long it was after Tennessee had ratified the woman suffrage amendment, that Mrs. Catt had a meeting, and I think it was in St. Louis, of all her following and all her officers to wind up the work of the National Woman Suffrage Association. And so she invited me to go with her, to go there to St. Louis and sit on the platform. And in the process, they wound up their organization and put it to bed financially, and they created the National League of Women Voters. I was there on the platform when that organization was created, and Mrs. Maud Wood Park became the new president. And at the end of that day, because of the skill I'd had in getting the minimum wage law passed in 6 months, that everybody said would take 2 years to get through the Congress, they appointed me as a legislative advocate for the National League of Women Voters.
Now that was as a paid position, like...
Oh, it was the highest salary of any woman was getting in Washington at that time.
Do you remember
what you were getting? $3,500. And there wasn't a woman that I'd ever heard of who was getting such a salary.
That was almost double what you'd gotten with the Consumers League then.
Oh, yes. Easily, and I didn't have to raise the money as I did with the Consumers League. And so we went back to Washington, and I was off of the Consumers League and into a big new job National League of Women Voters.
Do you remember what some of the lobbying was that you worked on then?
Well, that summer, we spent all that summer laying the groundwork for the work of the League with the Congress the next fall. But my work by this time became somewhat confused because this whole question of marriage had come up. And you can't think about getting married and still be completely sunk in the work of a reform movement like the National League of Women Voters. So I don't think I did so good a job that summer. And by fall, by December, we were married and took the great ship Aquitania to London.
Now, but you didn't leave for England for about 10 months after you were married, did you?
Oh, at once. We were married and went at once to England.
Oh, because I have down October 12, 1921 that you went to England.
No, we went to England. We were married on December 6, 1920, and 10 days later we were on the boat for England.
Okay. Now,
Wow.
Let's go back a little to...
May I say a word here? It's rather interesting. We got married, and then on a Saturday, and we're staying in a huge hotel in New York, and then an old college friend of mine had an apartment right on the right on the Great Park in New York. And so on the following Monday after we were married, I went out and sat on the seat in that park. And it was one of those crystal clear mornings that you get in New York City, just dazzling morning. And the reason I went out and sat on the seat was that I had been so disturbed over this step I'd taken that I hadn't had any time to pray about it. So I decided to go out on the seat and get myself calmed down because I now had gone into marriage, which I never meant to do. And as I sat there, a woman came out of the hotel right on the 85th Street carrying a little baby. Do you want this story? And what did she do but come right over and sit on my seat with her little girl? Well, my mother had been dead since I was 10. I'd had nobody to talk to. And that if ever a woman wants to talk to somebody, it's to her mother or somebody who knows something about marriage. So I started to tell her the boat I was in. And I described the life I'd had. She was very interested. And I started by asking her, was she scared when that baby was born? Because somehow or other I did want a child, scared as I was. And she said, oh no. She said, all the experiences of the ages come to women when they give birth to children. And so there's no reason for being scared. And I said, well, I'm scared. I'm scared stiff. I'm so scared. Before you came, I got to thinking about it, and I thought I'd fall off of this bench. I'm terrified of childbirth. But I would like to have some children, or one or two children. So she talked on in this soft voice about it, and how you got the courage, and how it was part of a woman's makeup, and all the memories of the age came to help you. And so when the time came, she said, I would find that it wasn't as terrifying as I thought it was. Well, of course, I didn't know who she was, and I didn't tell her who I was. And pretty soon, with her little girl, she departed. And I thought to myself, well, I'm still scared, but I think I can make it. Something's happened that's changed me. And to conclude this story, 30 years later, I again found this same woman in California, and she became my spiritual teacher. So somehow, she was sent there to me on that bench in Central Park, New York, of all places where thousands of people were, sat on the bench and helped me get started in my new life. And later, when I met her as a spiritual teacher, she literally saved my life.
Well, did you, before you changed your mind and decided to get married, had you thought that you wanted children then?
No, I hadn't thought that far ahead. The very thought of getting married was so terrifying, and having a family, having to run a home, and in the image that we have in America, that I would be cooped up in a home and have to cook meals and run a home. I hadn't got to the point of childbirth.
But did you regret your decision right afterwards then? Did you think you'd made a mistake?
No, I never regret decisions I've made. I stick them out. And I did have a horrible experience in London. I had got pregnant two or three years. And the seventh month, we went down to the Isle of Wight for the Easter holiday, and I had a perfectly horrible miscarriage that I would have died. Only one of Florence Nightingale's trained midwives found me in the hotel and delivered that baby and saved my life for the price of £1. The cheapest thing I found you can do in England is to have a baby, and that's still so. And that's a tremendous story. And that's why I spent later 6 years studying England's whole child welfare program that is perfectly tremendous, thanks to Florence Nightingale, who created it from her bed when she was an old woman.
So you assumed when you got married that you would definitely go ahead and have children.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were in
having made that decision, I don't back out from decisions.
Mm-hmm. When you were in Washington, were most of these, you were telling me about the canoe parties and everything that you took part in, were most of the women that you knew married in Washington there?
You mean the pals that we had? Mm-hmm. Well, did I tell you about our community house?
I want to find out about that, too. Why don't you talk about that now?
Well, my Hugh and I, this platonic pal of mine, got very tired. We both of us did, of living in rooming houses and going down to the drugstores and eating meals. And so one day I said, look, dear, why don't we get a nice big house all furnished and fill it full of our friends and let's have a home life? And he said, that's a great idea. The wonderful thing about my husband was that his mind was always open to new ideas. And you know, it's funny, but I think that's more important in an individual than anything else, to have a pal and a companion that is ready to take on new ideas and look at them and not say, oh, we could have never afforded it, or we'd lose money, or it would be a lot of work, oh, it would be a hideous idea. He said, that's a wonderful idea. So we did. We got a great big house, all furnished, and I think we had 10 or 16 of the men and women, some men and some women, working in Washington in World War I. They were all college people and having very good jobs. And we had a lovely married couple to come and live with us, so it was all very proper. And we had two houses, because in the summer, we went up to Glen Echo, up on the Potomac River, to a huge boarding house up there. Wonderful woman had a great boarding house up there, and she gave us, Hugh and me, a big table that all of us who had been living together in our big house came up there to live. And Hugh sat at the table, and I sat at the head of the table, and I sat at the end. And we all had canoes, and we spent the whole summer on the Potomac River canoeing and going way up the Potomac River to the other side, where somebody loaned us a shack, and we used to go up there with our sleeping bags and stay for the weekend. And it was gorgeous, and the work that we were both doing in the awful climate of Washington, it was a lifesaver. And then we came back and got another house, more beautiful house than the first house. And we, Hugh and I signed the contract, and we decided more or less who was to live in the house. And in that house, we had dances and roundtable discussions. My husband was a musician. We used to have people come and play music all evening. And we had dinner parties, and it was a really joy. We had a perfectly lovely time.
When did you first get the first communal house? Do you remember?
Well, it was about 2 or 3 years before we were married. Mm-hmm. And but every night Hugh and I had our dinners together, either there or downtown, because I had to get his help on all this tough work I was doing. Mental health, and I wasn't up to a lot of it. And by the way, he gave me the title to my speech that I made when I was on the trip with Carrie Chapman Catt. I read him the speech, because I didn't know how to make a speech without writing a manuscript and reading it, but he thought the title was horrible. So he gave me the title of The Government in the Market Basket, and that made my speech hit every newspaper through the whole tour.
Well, Jesse, how, in terms of the way the house functioned, did everyone eat together? Did the other people eat together?
No, everybody had a shelf in the kitchen.
I see.
And everybody got their own breakfast, because everyone went at different times of the day, and they had their own shelf, and somehow or other, I don't remember, but all seemed very harmonious and happy. There was no difficulty. And then, of course, at noon we were all downtown eating, and then at night, different people had different dinner parties, or we would plumb together and get one big dinner with everybody who's going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had several people in that house who liked to cook. And then I got little Helen Hill, who had worked with me with the Massachusetts Minimum Wage Commission, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Who tried to get me out of my job the minute I got there. Well, I got her a job in Washington with the Railroad Administration. So she came and lived in our house and loved figures, so she handled all the money. So that solved that question.
Did you share your money, or just for the rent?
Well, we had, everybody had a certain amount to pay, and we had it so arranged according to Helen Hill, which was very wise, so that there was enough money to pay for the rent of the house and all the rest of it, the phone and the light and so on.
But you didn't.
And we had a household assistant who came every week and cleaned up the house for us. Oh, it was a lovely, just a delightful life as compared to the life. One of the terrible problems in this country that somebody must settle, and it must be done soon. Women and men who go to college and have all those years of companionship, then they go into a city and work. And they have no companionship, no place to meet people, no place to go and have fun. It's a hideous gap in our civilization. I have a friend now, a young, beautiful young girl, 21 years old, graduate from a college in Southern Illinois. And she has an important job, but she has no companionship. She doesn't know where to go to meet people. And it's an awful gap in our civilization, because these young people, especially college people, that then go to work in cities and so on, are important people. They're going to, eventually, they run into somebody somehow by accident, let us say, and get married, and have families. But they're the makeup of important people that are going to be important citizens to our country. And yet there's no kind of arrangement for them to have any sort of community life or fun. I had a plan in Washington to get one of the beautiful big houses on Massachusetts Avenue and get a big club organized and have that for a sort of club for business women working for the government, because the situation in Washington is desperate. There are more women working in Washington in our government than men. And they're such lonely women, and their wives are lonely. And yet they're fine women, and hundreds of them never get married, never find a way to meet anybody to get married. Yet a lot of them would like to be married. It was really just seemingly an accident, my meeting my husband. But he was the right one for me. So my spiritual teacher says that the angel of the man helps him to point out his wife. in a hurry. They certainly, many of them do it in a hurry. And she says they're guided by their guardian angel to get the right girl.
Were the women, do you remember how many women were in the house?
I don't remember the numbers of how many were together, but there was a very interesting love story developed in our midst. Do you want to hear what that story was? Well, one day, a canoe load of us were paddling up the Potomac River when a terrible storm came, rainstorm, and we had to pull the canoe over onto the Virginia side and get under cover, and pretty soon the rain stopped, and we looked up on the hill, and there was a cabin, and on the porch was 6 Army officers for the weekend. And they were rather astounded when through the shrubbery appeared 4 women in a canoe, drenched with rain and in bathing suits, suddenly appeared on the scene. So they invited us all up to their porch to get out of the rain. And one of the men was a high officer in the United States Army in the listing section where the men were listed who were appointed, who were, went to war. And he took a tremendous fancy to one of our women with us, who was a very brilliant girl. She was had a very high position in Washington. And before we knew it, they were having a tremendous a love affair. And I warned her, I said, I think that man's got a family somewhere. You better slow down. You don't want to get mixed up with a married man with a family in the background. And she said, Jesse, don't make me mad. Of course I wouldn't do such a thing. Of course he has no family. But after they got very much in love and he wanted to marry her, she discovered he did have a wife back in New Jersey. So she said, well, she was not marrying a man with a wife and taking him away from her, from his wife. And she told him goodbye forever. And it was a most tremendous affair. He had had a very rich life in the Army, and his wife was a nice little woman glued to the home and the kitchen stove. And so he'd grown and she hadn't grown. This my friend, was a highly evolved woman and gave him a companionship that he needed and was ready for. But anyway, she just told him she couldn't see him anymore, and he went back to New Jersey when the war was over and made $1 million, went back to his wife. And she practically faded away. I've never seen anybody sink as she did over that affair. Well, finally, at the end of 3 years, his wife went to Maine to build a beautiful vacation house for them. And she was up there, very clever at that sort of thing. And one day she was driving down across the country, and she got onto a railroad track, and the train came, and she was instantly killed. So, at the end of the year, he wrote to Dorothy and said he still wanted to marry her. And they were married, and they had a tour around the world. And then they had a beautiful home in Washington, and she was over 40, and she had 2 wonderful girls after 40 years of age. And he lived for many years. They had the most wonderful marriage you ever heard of. So that was one of them. The other one was named Mabel, and she was one of those women. She was a woman. She had a high position in the Interior Department, and she had supported her mother all these years. So it's very hard for those girls to get married. But finally, she met a very attractive man, and they got engaged. But she wouldn't get married. She was the type of girl that if she was going to marry, she had to have all the right clothes ready, all the material ready for marriage. She was a born homemaker, but a perfectionist. So she begged him to wait a year till she could get properly ready for marriage. And in that year, he finally went down somewhere to Texas. I think he was interested in the oil wells down there. And you know, they had a terrible fire, and he was instantly killed. So that girl never got married, ever. It nearly wrecked her life.
So it was just the three women then in the house?
So it was just those two women, especially. And meanwhile, though, the girl that married the army officer got hold of me, and she said that Hugh and I were in love with each other and we didn't know it. And that it was going to be a terrible thing if we didn't get married. And I said that, well, why don't you talk to him about it? And she said, oh, there would be no use to talk to him because his mother's around and she wouldn't put up with it. And anyway, she said, we will all die if you and Hugh don't get married, because it would be a wonderful marriage, and it's just horrible to think that you don't even know you're in love with each other. So that was the other romance that developed.
Were the other women feminists, do you think, Jesse?
Well, no. I was a real feminist. I've always been, from birth.
Now, that, before we go into more about your marriage and leaving for England, I wanted to ask you more about some of your ideas at the time. How you defined your feminism then, what you expected for women, what you were hoping would happen when women got the vote. What were your own attitudes and some of the other attitudes about these, the women who lived in the house, about sex, for instance, at that time? What sort of general ideas you had with regard to women?
Well, it's perfectly extraordinary, but in those days we did not discuss sex publicly or privately. You've got to remember. I remember when Leslie Cutler, my pupil in Massachusetts, found the when she found that hospital where all the little blind children were, who had been born to families that had venereal disease. And so when she got up into the state legislature and discussed venereal disease publicly, and this home, and described what she'd seen there, so these men would pass the law that she was advocating, that no one should marry in Massachusetts who wasn't tested physically to be sure they didn't have venereal disease, because the other states had that law. But so everybody who wanted to marry and didn't want to be tested physically went to Massachusetts to get married, and that's why they had all those children there. But I remember when she discussed venereal disease in the state assembly, and what the children looked like and what it was like. And such a thing had never been done publicly anywhere. People did not discuss venereal disease. It's incredible. And I remember in that house, we used to occasionally talk about family life and all, but I never heard any discussion about sex. It was utterly out of the world. We were interested in politics, in government, and in social questions, and our lives were involved with that sort of thing. So that question never came up. It was just non-existent. And so when this love affair with the army officer appeared, it was something out of the blue that happened, you see. And nobody knew about it except me.
It would have been considered very scandalous, even among the people in that house?
Well, not scandalous exactly, but we were surprised that she would... that this woman would be so interested in having a love affair instead of carrying on with her noble job that she was doing. We were all rather dedicated people to social questions and a better country and a better world. We seemed to think we'd risen above that, the petty questions of marriage and sex and so forth, and we weren't involved in it. Had nothing to do with us. So that was that question. Now you had some other ones.
Now, so someone like Hazel Hunkinson, even among the feminists, was very unusual in her attitudes about sex and her having any sort of relationship and not getting married. That, even among the feminists, was rather unusual then?
Well, I don't think that Hazel discussed that question with anybody but me. They seemed to like to do it with me because, being a philosopher, I liked to know what was going on, and so they could take it up with me. And so I had quite a lot of talks with her about it. but I disapproved of her, so she couldn't get very far with me on the subject. She sensed that I was disapproving of her program. I didn't think it was a very good program. And you had some other questions.
What at the time, if you can recall and separate out, you know, how you now feel and what you now think should happen, at the time, what your feminist ideas were, what did you think would happen to women, what did you think should happen, and how did you think it was all going to turn out?
Well, you see, in a way, I was dedicated to helping women, and I've been so all my life. I'll tell a story about that that came up in England after I had that terrible miscarriage and nearly died. I found that same goal, that something in me seemed to want to help women have a better life. I'd had a very bad life as a child. Everybody did in those pioneer days. They were rough days. The parents and the fathers and mothers were going through such terrible experiences to just survive that they felt if they got the children fed and clothes on, that was the best. That was the best they could do. So that I can't tell you that story. It's a very terrible story of things that happened, and tragic, full of tragedies. So that I was interested in helping women have a better chance in life. And then I had had one experience as a child that had made me wipe out the whole memory of it. I no longer remembered it at all. I just remembered I didn't want to get into family life anymore. And so it took the one thing I got out of Smith College, which is a classical college and is not the kind of college that a woman with a mind like mine should go to. In a classical college, you read the great literature and you listen to the great talks, and then you write down in the examinations what you've read and heard, but you don't tell what you think about it. And I always, instead of writing what I'd read, I discussed what I'd read, and then I discussed what I thought of it. And I didn't get very high marks for that. That wasn't the kind of thinking that in those days that classical college wanted, and I don't think they do yet today. But at Smith College, I did find the first course in psychology in America. And as a result of that, I took psychology, philosophy, ethics, logic, everything that was in that department. I took 2 solid years of philosophy. I didn't understand any of it much, but I did take it. And when I got to London and got was married, I found that being married was different from being a lobbyist at the Capitol. It's quite a different thing when you get into the emotional situation of marriage and childbirth, because it's not an intellectual situation, it's an emotional, physical situation. And I was not prepared for that at all. And so after I had this frightful miscarriage and nearly died, I was sitting out in a bench. When I sit on benches, things seem to happen. And I was on a bench in the Isle of Wight, sitting on the getting over this miscarriage and looking at the water and crying. I cried steadily for 2 weeks for having had this frightful experience, and to think that I'd been so blind and so ignorant that I hadn't known how to meet the situation. When a little woman came and sat on the bench with me, and I was still crying, and I told her why I was crying. And this is the story she told me. She'd been a missionary in China for many years and had had no children. And one day she and her husband were walking along a road through the fields, and they heard a baby crying. And they went over, and it was a little girl baby that had been thrown away. And in those days, nothing could be more unimportant than having a girl baby, so they just threw them away as soon as they were born, out in the shrubbery to die. Because babies in China produced more people, and more people went hungry. So the only thing to do was to have no girl babies. So this darling missionary picked up the little baby and brought her home. And her, both she and her husband were so fascinated with her, they decided to keep her. And so they brought her up in China. And now, at the moment that she was talking to me, that baby had turned into a brilliant woman and was in New York City about to graduate from the biggest hospital for doctors in America. So she could go back to China and